This is Regenerative Skills, the podcast helping you to learn the skills and solutions to create an abundant and connected future. I'm your host, Oliver Gaucher. Are you left wanting more at the end of each episode of this show? Are these short sessions getting you fired up to try new skills for yourself and share the journey with others who are working through the same challenges? Well, the good news is that this podcast is only the beginning. The real action and learning is happening on the Regenerative Skills Discord channel, where you can connect with the whole community to dive deeper into the topics on the show, explore solutions, and share your journey and blooper reel with an active group that can't wait to hear from you. You can get your questions answered and share knowledge and wisdom of your own on a safe platform that, unlike the social media giants, won't steal your personal data to advertise to you in creepy ways. Ditch Facebook and join us where the real skill builders are. Just find the link to the Discord chat on the homepage at regenerativeskills.com. Hey everybody, and welcome back. So despite the popularity of permaculture, homesteading, and regen ag, and all of these other buzz terms that we hear, many of the people promoting these ideas are quite new and inexperienced, and I include myself here even though I've been doing this for almost a decade. It's still rare to find people who can offer insight and wisdom from decades or a whole lifetime of living with regenerative systems. Now, sure, you can still find quite a few hardy old-timers who know a lot about resilience and self-sufficiency, but even though there's a ton of wisdom to be gleaned from those experiences, I've found that many of them are lacking in the whole picture and systems-level thinking that informs a regenerative worldview. And I've been lucky enough to interview and highlight some of those voices on this show in the past, and today is another example of a person whose work and life philosophy has been a big inspiration to me. Many of you may know Ben Falk as the developer of Whole Systems Design LLC, his company created as a land-based response to biological and cultural extinction and the increasing separation between people and elemental things. Life as a designer, builder, ecologist, tree tender, and backcountry traveler continually informs Ben's integrative approach to developing landscapes and buildings. His home landscape and the WSD studio site in Vermont's Mad River Valley serve as a proving ground for the regenerative land development featured on the project of Whole Systems Design. Ben studied architecture and landscape architecture at the graduate level and holds a master's degree in land use planning and design. He's conducted more than 650 site development and land inspection consultations across the U.S. and abroad, and has facilitated dozens of courses on property selection, permaculture design, and resilient systems. He's given keynote addresses and presented dozens of workshops at venues ranging from the Bioneers to the Omega Institute. And Ben is the author of an award-winning book, The Resilient Farm and Homestead, and serves as an advisory council for the International Regeneration Group Ecosystem Restoration Camps, which is incidentally how I first got in touch with him back when I worked with that organization. Now, today we're going to be going beyond the typical talking points of regenerative design principles and reading the landscape and life hacks for permaculture enthusiasts, partly because we already went over them in the first interview he and I did together a couple of seasons ago. Instead, Ben and I explore the reflections that he has had on over two decades of living the lifestyle that he designs and promotes for others. We look into the biggest learnings that have come from evolving alongside and in service to perennial food systems, as well as what he might do differently if he could go back and redesign things. Ben also explains how his life experience has informed his design work and his consultancy for clients, the patterns that have emerged from the endless experiments that he's run, and where his focus is on this stage of his life, both in his family and personal life, as well as his work on the land. Now, since I'm only in the second year of designing and building my own farmstead, I find it invaluable to gain insights into all of these reflections, almost as a way to peek into one of a million possible futures in hopes of setting a solid foundation and maybe even avoiding some of the pitfalls that are inevitably ahead of me. It's worth mentioning too that Ben has published the video version of this episode on his own channels, which I'll link to in the show notes. And though in these first few minutes we talk about it being a shame that we can't show his sunny view of his snow-covered property in the podcast, we actually did get a snippet of video that is now on the episode page on the website as well, so have a look there if you get a chance. It's really beautiful. So with that out of the way, I'll hand things over now to Ben Falk. So welcome back, Ben. It's great to have you on the show again. How are you doing?
I'm good. It's great. Good to be here. Sunny day, so can't complain. I was going to say, it's a shame that we don't have the video published for this because it looks gorgeous where you are. You said you've been having a pretty mild winter so far.
Yeah, it has been probably the second most mild since I've been here for 20, well, in Vermont for 25 years and on our first site for 21. And yeah, it didn't get below 0 Fahrenheit, which is, what is that, probably 15 below Celsius, maybe? Not very cold.
Yeah, it's been really mild for us here too. But this is exactly what I want to explore with you because you've been on your site now for over 2 decades and you've accompanied that experience with an updated, a revised version of the book that a lot of people know you from, which is The Resilient Farm and Homestead. So let's start with that. So since you've been on this land, can you kind of reflect back on the mentality, the mindset that you went into it with? And how that's changed over more than 2 decades of living there.
Yeah, I think the mindset has experienced quite a few changes, but also has been one of the things that stayed more constant than some, you know, I think certain projects have changed a lot, changed completely, certain, you know, physical manifestations. And then, but the mindset has experienced, let's say, big changes on certain things, but not any changes maybe on other things in terms of goals or things I enjoy. But I would say with the biggest thing, one of the biggest things that's changed mentally is that I no longer am just focused on trying stuff. I think the first book version I ended with just try stuff, you know, which I still think is the right message for most people. But once you're about 10, 15 years in, it's more like now dial it all in. Let's refine stuff. And so that's been what I'm really focused on more now is refining than just trying new things.
So that's really interesting because obviously I am not at that level of experience with my own farm. I've only been here for just over a year now. What is the difference in how you approach your day-to-day activities and your planning for the place when you move into refinement instead of experimentation?
Yeah, I think it's a lot of different things. I mean, in the beginning, I think I'm just there's so many things that I wanted to try. You don't really know what's going to like your site, what systems are really going to do well, what species are going to thrive. I mean, even if you just pick a very pretty localized plant list, okay, these are all zone 4 and 5 plants. It's still like, no, they're not all going to do well on that site. They some are going to do well on other sites in your zone, in your climate zone, and some are going to not do well. And it's going to vary even from other sites near you to some extent due to microclimate, due to soils, especially. And then never mind, you're going to find that you like certain yields a lot more than others, and you don't really end up doing a lot with some of the yields. So, but I didn't know any, you know, early on 20 years ago to 15, 12, 10 years ago, that was all still new. So what did a sea berry taste like? Like I had no idea before I started planting them because they weren't here available. Same even with black currants. I mean, I could have sought those out, but they're still not very common. You know, medlars, quinces, Nanking cherries, cornelian cherries. I mean, so many things we've planted, you know, I never saw growing around here, so I couldn't try. So that was, yeah, there was 5 to 10 years needed to just throw it all at the wall and see what sticks, including not just species, but systems, ways of growing, ways of managing water and soil, swales, ponds, paddies, raised beds, you know, you name it, different ways of doing things. A keyhole garden. There's like an example of something I won't do again. I don't think I'll make a keyhole garden. You know, I like straight garden paths. You know, that's really works well for us. Not that keyhole gardens don't have a place. So as far as how it goes day to day, I mean, I think I just now have much more of an eye out for where are the sub-optimizations, where are the inefficiencies, where am I spending too much time for not enough results, and how do I either remove those things from the system or dial them in? So like organization's been a big one, dialing in my workshop. I mean, the last 10 years I've just made my shops just dialed, like everything, finding a home. I don't have a home for everything, but for like 999 out of 1,000 things, there's like a specific home. And, you know, to the point of like that tool goes right here. It doesn't just go on in this area on a magnet. Like it goes in this part of that, you know, it's like all of that adds up to a much more effective and enjoyable existence because, you know, looking for stuff sucks. I mean, I spent a lot of time in the first 5 to 10 years, you know, looking for a tool, looking for a material to do projects with. And it's like that's been a big area of focus. It's just organization. And yeah, I think the day is just much more organized around tweaking systems than just, you know, trying a lot of new stuff. I still try new things. Don't get me wrong. I'm going to try a new squash. Just ordered a new squash variety this morning. I mean, I'm still trying new species every year, but not like dozens of new species and not, you know, lots of new systems, but some here and there.
Sure. And I can still see how your experience in experimenting regularly has informed the way that you're now refining things. Like you're still optimizing, you're still trying to figure out the better way or the way that suits you the best. But it seems like with the experience of having tried so many things, you have a good perspective of, well, it's not even worth going there. I've done so many things and that none of them have worked out. And yeah. So you can hone in a little bit more about the few more direct experiments that you're still trying. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, it does inform heavily the kinds of experiments that I will even spend time investing in trying now, because you kind of have a library of patterns that work, a library of patterns that are like, no, there's too many warning signs around that. I'm not even going to invest my time in it because it has so many characteristics of things that didn't work that it's like, that's unlikely to be good. So that does inform a lot. I mean, and maintenance too is the other big thing. So I'm looking out right now. Did you say this won't be available in video or will it be?
No, the podcast isn't in video. So you're going to have to visually
that's
walk
fine.
Us through
that's
with your
fine.
Words.
Yeah. I'm on our strongest microclimate or microclimate right now, because it's literally blowing, you know, 30 to 40 kilometers an hour right now. But right here, the air is actually pretty still and I'm totally warm, even though it's 25 degrees Fahrenheit. That's like below zero Celsius. Yeah. And I could have this sweatshirt. I'm just wearing a sweatshirt on top of some long underwear that I could almost be bare chested and be totally comfortable in the sunshine. But I bring this up because I'm looking out now on the landscape and I'm looking at, like, you know, a sixth of the trees that are in zone one here, I just want to cut out. They're not really producing. I'm looking at an apricot right here. It's never yielded apricots. It's kind of starting to shade some areas. I could grow some herbs. And so, yeah, we're at the phase of where it's deduction more than addition. You know, we're using a pruning saw and chainsaw now, where in the past we were just using planting spades and things like that. So now it's biomass harvesting and cutting plant material out and focusing, which is good. I mean, that's a yield. That's an important yield. And focusing on how do we make things more maintainable, like more grazable, more mowable, more scythable, because maintenance, you know, you design and you implement but then you maintain forever.
Yeah.
Really, that's really an emphasis. Not that you're always not designing, at least some extent you are, and you're always implementing maybe to some extent, but the maintenance is just that piece of the pie just gets bigger and bigger and bigger as years go on.
Yeah.
And I'm not getting younger and younger and younger. So those are crossing curves, you know, of maintenance. Sure. And so we want maintenance. My ability to maintain is just going to go down as I get older, and the maintenance needs could rise. So those are not viable curves to enter stuff like that. So I have to figure out how to get that maintenance line to parallel, you know, my physical abilities and interests too over time. And that's a real trick. And to some extent, it's impossible. I have a six-year-old who's coming up and he'll hopefully, he'll help with that. But, and you could also work on the other line, which is to always focus on my health more and more. So I'm focused on my zone zero, the body mind system, way more now than I was when I wrote the first book version, because I'm older, you know, I need to be. You're between year 40 and 50, you have to do that more than between year 30 and 40 or 20 and 30, which is when I was writing the first book.
That makes a lot of sense. When you're in the experimentation phase, when you have more energy, when, you know, you're not going as much for refinement, you can afford to make those, I don't want to call them mistakes, but, you know, those difficult learnings that your body can absorb more. And as you go into a different phase, both in the maturity of the system and in the maturity of your own body and your mindset, it totally makes sense the way you've shifted your focus now. And that makes me want to ask, if you could go back and talk with yourself when you were designing some of this stuff, with this reflection that you have on what is now necessary to maintain, what would you tell yourself back then to maybe prepare for or make it a little bit easier for the situation you're currently in?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question right there. there's a lot of different things. You know, one that occurred to me the other day in a mimetic, you know, very simplistic format is learn to weld earlier. You know, learn to do metalworking. Learn to do metalworking at the beginning. You know, why did I wait till I was 38 or whatever to start welding? Like, I could have saved myself a lot of time, a lot of money, and made things better, more optimized the whole time if I had just been welding from the beginning, like I had some familiarity with woodworking. It's easier than woodworking. It's harder to trash the tools. It's just so much more. I mean, they're both very applicable, but metalworking is so key. That's one. And then I'm actually getting to blacksmithing right now. And that's another, like, super baseline. Like, you can learn to forge some metal early on because you can make a lot of tools that you need, even if you're not very good at it. I mean, you know, and it's harder than welding, I will say, but those basic trades, you know, same with wiring and plumbing. I mean, I've had to learn a lot of wiring and plumbing as I go. People who come into homesteading, farming, permaculture, you name it, any land type relationship, hands-on living from the trades have a huge advantage because even if you just really know one trade well, they transfer those skills and ways of working and confidence and ability to figure things out and work with your hands transfer into everything else that you need to know how to do to be in this lifestyle. So yeah, all of those things I would emphasize earlier. I mean, I went to, you know, I had an academic background. I went to college, undergrad and graduate school, so I didn't go to trade school. So I don't know. Would I do that differently early on? Maybe. And then, you know, on other ends, I mean, design-wise, this site that I'm on now is very constricted in terms of access. So I like to think, oh, I would have made better access. In reality, there's boulders and wetland and like seeps of water and even small cliffs all over this property. So it doesn't have great access no matter what I could have done. I mean, short of like really earthworking, like big mounded up roads, which I've done in places. But, you know, access is so key, and just designing around access first and foremost, you know, after slope and water, some of the higher scales of permanence is so key. I mean, and that really limits what we can do on this site a lot. And again, it's inherently challenging here for those reasons I mentioned, but I think I would have had a stronger eye to that from the beginning. I mean, the 10 acres of our original site in some ways can be more management intensive than 20 or 30 of the acres on our second site.
That's really interesting. And the one thing that I can kind of weigh in on what you said is that my background is in the trades, and I came from construction, and I was a marine engineer before getting into, well, mostly natural building first and then permaculture and regen ag from there. And I can definitely vouch for the fact that those skills, though I couldn't see it at the beginning, especially now that I'm renovating, you know, a 1,000-year-old house, are proving invaluable and certainly going to save me money, as much as I wish my welding was up to snuff as well. That's something I'll definitely think about putting more energy into. But just being handy and knowing how to fix and do and make things that are otherwise extremely expensive to pay someone else to do properly, or at least be able to supervise. That's definitely what I found useful.
Absolutely. Yeah. Those trades are really baseline.
Yeah. And so you kind of alluded to this in a previous answer already, that some of the things that you're trying to refine and optimize for are being guided by ideas like putting in less energy, having things more organized so that you don't waste time doing them. And this is something that I've always found to be interesting to get a window into the people that I interview, which is what are sort of the guiding metrics of success that you are using to help you make decisions and improve your systems over time? Have those stayed the same since when you started, or have those shifted along with the evolution of your place?
Some have stayed the same and some have shifted, and that's a great question. And I will say I do that in a very gut way. I don't do that very systematically. I mean, in some ways, I've been fortunate to be successful enough. I haven't had to really like spreadsheet it all out.
Mm.
I guess is what I'm getting at. So, like, I don't run every single thing that I'm going to do on this site through a, you know, cost benefit analysis of, okay, sure, this is going to take this much time. It's going to take this much capital investment, and it's going to give me this and this economic yield projected in year 5 and 10 and 20. You may need to do that. I'm not saying don't do that. I do that on big projects that are a stretch, but I don't do that on so many of the things we do because I'm comfortable enough to absorb the risk and I can go by my gut instead. I'll make that as a disclaimer early on. And some of the ways that I evaluate the success of things, you know, that I'm doing in my life is just more so like the livability and the enjoyment factor and the versus the burnout factor. And especially the impact like on my marriage and on my family life, like, because that's where, to me, I can do a lot of things and what I really, and they all are pretty cool for the most part. But when they get not cool, it's not that they are a big economic loss. I haven't had many of those types of experiences. I mean, I'm sure it's possible and many do, but I haven't had a lot of run-ins with that. It's that they just start become a time suck and tap, you know, otherwise really valuable time that I could be spending with my family, especially. So, I mean, my time, you know, is the limiting factor in so far in my life. I mean, that could totally change, but so far that's been the real limiting piece that I really am always trying to design around and feeling out what is it that I'm doing and how does that affect that bottom line of my time. And so that's what I run. Everything has to pass that litmus test. And that's why a lot of things, you know, get thrown out over time. It's like, okay, that's no longer worth my time doing that thing, whatever it is, you know. Growing rice is one thing. It's just, yeah, could I still grow rice? Yeah. But the weeds and the birds, like all of that made it, you know, not worth like how many hours I was willing to put into growing, you know, that crop. And yeah, there's been a number of things like that. So yeah, I don't know. I don't know if there's any other nuances to that question. I'm happy to try to delve deeper because I think it's an important topic.
I agree. And I really like your observations on this. It tracks really well with the conversations that I have with farmers in our network, that when it comes to optimizing things on the farm or on the business, there's kind of two camps. There's those who really look at it analytically and go to the spreadsheets and try and calculate things and really define what it is the outcomes are that they're looking for. And there are others who don't necessarily operate that way, or that's not how they like to do their calculations and prefer to fall back on observation. Now, that, of course, requires that you really be present and careful in how you're listening and the spectrum of things that you're observing as you run experiments or as you, you know, put together projects. You can't necessarily rely on observation if you're not living very close to the system or the results of the project that you're doing, right? That way of doing things is dependent on a certain amount of presence and listening that goes along with it. And that'd be,
yeah. And if you have an investor and you're spending someone else's money, like, yeah, then you have to go by all those hard metrics. Yeah. But yeah, I think we work with clients like that. And I think I've seen enough projects where people succeed according to what the plan is they have, but like their life, they're still not happy with like their life. They might be like, oh, the project's awesome, but their true, you know, holistic context, if you want to call it that, or their real bottom line of like, is this an awesome day-to-day existence? often comes up short. And so then it's like you can have a super successful business plan, but an unsuccessful day-to-day life experience. Okay, great. That successful business plan to me should be a subset of like how happy is your life. And for me, it's just been, it's always the gut day-to-day meshing in the system and observations I can make give me a lot more information than just what a spreadsheet can do. Actually, I've had the experience that after some years, I refer back to some business planning spreadsheet I made for a specific project. And sometimes even when the project's like as successful as I projected, I kind of just gave it up and moved on to other things. I was like, okay, that was just not interesting to me anymore.
Yeah.
It's easy to be, to just get beholden to numbers, I think, for a lot of humans. I mean, some of us, I think, are made differently. I think I am one of them, but I think I'm surprised how many people just can be compelled by a plan and by numbers to just spend like years of their life.
Yeah.
By those guideposts.
Well, so let's go deeper into that then, because you were talking about your metrics for success being much more pegged to the quality of life and what you're able to do with your time. And this is really what I've found too, especially with these broader conversations that I'm having, is you can reach that financial success or the success of the outcomes of a project as they appear on a piece of paper. And if that does not translate into a higher quality of life or a larger feeling of fulfillment that would come along with that, it's not really success. And you mentioned the holistic context standard, and personally why I like to use that as a tool, because those auditing questions cause you to think about, well, what is the quality of life that you hope to have around the project that you are trying to get going? Because if you're not contributing and this project is not bringing you closer to that quality of life, well, what's your real idea of success?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I have some, metrics that might be pretty unusual on that front. I mean, one of them that has been activated in the last few weeks is, can I wake up whenever it snowed a lot and it's the sky clears up and it's a beautiful starry night and going to be a beautiful dawn? Can I get out of bed at 3:30 or 4 in the morning and go ski up a local mountain for sunrise and, a beautiful ski outing? And be back by, 9, 10 o'clock. If some project is likely to make that not the case, then it's like, okay, I'm not likely to want to take on that project. And, that may sound really flimsy, but like, that's a hard metric. Like that, and I have a lot of metrics like that and I don't write them down, but what they end up being is like, how spontaneous can I actually be? That's kind of, I think, what they have in common is like, and I think that is something that's a guidepost that a lot of people could use is, well, how spontaneous can my life be in this or this situation? And for me, I need to be able to lead a spontaneous existence because I like to be based around the weather. Sun comes out here once in 2 weeks in the winter.
Yeah.
I need to be able to go out in the sunshine for just my own personal mental health, well-being, ability to be a good father. Based on the downstream effects of that, a good husband. Now you could say, oh, well, that means you must have not a lot of spiritual discipline. You can't go out in the sun for 2 weeks. If you could just avoid that and still be a good husband and father, sure, maybe. Then maybe that's, I'm acknowledging my things I need, that I'm weak about. But whatever it is, that's the reality. And so, I have, there's dozens of kind of quality of life metrics that I have like that. And I think that they pretty much, it seems, all come back to that ability to the ability of being able to be spontaneous in my day to day.
And I really like that for two reasons. Like you said, this could probably apply to most people, the ability to be spontaneous, to really take advantage of the unexpected opportunities that life gives you, that nature gives you, that you can't schedule in ahead of time and be available to make the most of them. But at the same time, you used a very explicit, specific example of being able to get up early in the morning when it's sunny, those few opportunities, and go skiing. Like, that to me is what makes a metric around spontaneity tangible and observable for an individual and not just some broad term that you're not really sure how it applies to your life. That is something that I have found to be really important for me in connecting with the broader concepts that you might articulate or put out in a holistic context. How did this actually work out for you in your own life? Do you have any other examples like that?
Yeah, I mean, whether I can think of them or not, it's a good another question, but there, I mean, there's so many all the time. I mean, you know, in the summer, if it's beautiful, like being able to go out down to the pond and spend some time swimming and sunbathing, or going down to the river, you know, in the bottom of my valley, or be able to go see family, you know, if there's a time that they need me, and you know, I have enough unscheduled time that I can just do that. Same with being available for my son or my wife. Just, yeah, I think the ability to just do what in the moment becomes a priority, not what's planned to be the priority, but what surfaces as the priority each and every day. And I think working with living systems, I mean, that's the dance. Like we have to be able to do that. And if we are programmed and scheduled a lot, we're not going to be dancing with the unfolding manifestation of the living place we reside, and of our relationship within that as a participant as well. Like that really demands that we see the rain start coming down hard from the sky and go outside and watch how that water's flowing, and not, oh, well, I was on a meeting for an hour when that happened. I missed all that information. And that can add up to years and years of missed information. It does.
Yeah.
There's 1,000 things like that every year that when they're happening, the wind just from this particular spot or this wildlife phenomenon, these animals moving through this area and doing this in this spot. But did you miss it or did you witness it? And being able to witness as much of the life of the system as possible directly plays into how effective you can be as a, you know, keystone species in that system, designer, manager of that system. And it's also, to me, about the best reason to do all of this, reason to live this way, is to be in that dance, to be that in participation, not to be the, you know, the somewhat absent manager that just kind of checks in on the assembly line floor every now and then when there's a problem. Like, that's not, you know, that's not very engaging, I don't think. Like, it's not an embodiment of, you know, of the texture and joy of, like, what it is to be a member of a place, you know, of a living place. And I thirst to be part of that more each year. You know, we stepped outside the other night, my wife and son and I, and we're just like, we're so... For us, we still feel like there's so much closer connection we can have with this place. And so many people would look at what we do and be like, oh, wow, you live so close to nature. And like, yeah, maybe compared to most, but it's still like could be so much closer. Like we should be sleeping outside 100 nights a year, not, you know, 30 or whatever. You know, yeah. It's just all of that. I mean, we live in a time where we have a lot of commitments and choices that I'm on the computer or the phone. And like, I mean, one of my goals is to just have that be less and less time every year, you know, by the time I'm 60 or something. I don't have a specific time, but like I never look at my phone would be a good goal. Because I'm looking instead at soil and water and fish and plants and stars or whatever have you. You know, we all only have 24 hours in a day. And yeah, our time's the most valuable thing. But I mean, a lot of people who are struggling to pay the bills, I get if they hear this and say, oh, wow, you know, what a privilege. It is totally is a privilege. And I would recommend that everyone try to get enough financial comfort so that they can start taking those steps to be able to move towards spontaneity, because it does take, you know, there is a baseline you have to do. And when I have been at hungrier times in my life, or under more financial stress, then yeah, the spontaneous ability, you know, is going to go down, is going to pay the price. But I wish all humans could be more spontaneous. I was just reading some Marshall Salen's work about, you know, the original affluent society, about hunter-gatherer cultures, and just how far we are as an industrial culture from truly having like a lot of time on our hands to immerse, you know, like that, how much time humans at in other periods have really had to engage in the world around them. It's hard for us to even appreciate, you know, just how little of it we have as modern humans.
And that's exactly why I like to ask the question about what the metrics, what the idea of success that one is pursuing is, because if we listen to that narrative that, you know, prehistoric life or pre-industrial life was this brutish, short, horrible existence, which is obvious fallacy, and you compare that to how most people live in urgency and scarcity, in slavery to timetables, like which one of those would you prefer to have? There are certain levels of comfort that we are paying dearly for in other ways that not everybody would go back to that compromise if they're really given a choice. And what you just articulated there is one of my new favorite ways of talking about the difference between this superficial way of talking about, oh, I need to get out of the city and reconnect with nature. I'm going to put my headphones on, my plastic sports gear, and go for a run in a forest, as in contrast to developing a real interconnected relationship with the environment around you in a mutualistic sense where you are dependent on what it can give to you, while at the same time, your existence is dependent on your stewardship and the interactions that you form with it in exchange. And to me, that shatters this concept of reconnecting to nature as like, let's go for an excursion in the woods for a little while.
Right. Yeah. I mean, if you just think of the place around you, you know, the trees and the animals and all of the plants, and even, you know, even say the sky and whatever else, the rocks around you, if you start just pretend for a minute that they're valuable like other people are valuable, like your presence to them matters. Yeah. I know it's a pretty far-fetched idea, even for me to think of. But if you kind of try to believe that for a minute, and then you think, okay, so what type of existence would you lead if that was something you really felt was true? You'd be doing things, for the most part, a lot of people would be doing things very differently and really trying to have presence to that world around them, like as if it was alive and it cared about your presence.
Yeah.
And then it's not hard to imagine that you might feel a lot differently about being in that place, like you would if you were giving presence to the people around you versus if you weren't. How enjoyable would it be to be in a family who was all looking at their phones all the time, like, or a group of friends? You wouldn't feel very held by them because you weren't also giving them presence. And I think the same is true in the non-human world. If we start, and my wife is a real master of this, I say this as somewhat of a note to self, but she gets this on a very fundamental level. And so the place holds her in return for her presence. And I'm a student of this for sure in a big way, or always will be. But whereas I think some people master that art a lot better. And so it offers her more holding in return. She sees wildlife and different things that I don't see, because I'm kind of, I give the place some presence, but I'm also kind of busy and kind of walking fast and kind of thinking about other things, you know, a lot more than she is. And yeah, it takes a certain level of trust, right? Mm-hmm. And like you brought up scarcity mindset. Like we can't do that out of a scarcity mindset. Like, oh, I'm too busy, I don't have enough time today, et cetera, et cetera. Like you can't have that. Just like, are you going to have a good conversation with a friend if that's what you're thinking as you're talking to them?
Yeah, definitely. Well, look, let's bring the conversation to a different point of focus for a second. Since you've been communicating and a part of the small farm homesteading movement from 2 decades back and moving now into where we are, a lot has happened. I mean, the narrative around homesteading has changed. It's absorbed the things like prepping. It's gone through a pandemic and has, well, recently been very well advertised and sold as a package to people who kind of preying on their fears and their tendency to want to disconnect from the system. Mm-hmm. Now, this was always an element of it since I've, you know, been aware of the movement, and that's not that long ago. How have you observed the change in narrative and the focuses around homesteading and farming since you started to where they are now?
Yeah, it has been. I think you encapsulated it pretty well. I mean, I remember when the prepping world like picked up permaculture, and that was kind of like, I don't know. You know, that was a little weird. And then it was like, well, that's good. I mean, you know, as long as it's permaculture that people come to understand versus just a co-opted, you know, word. And I think it's been both.
Herb spiral in your bomb shelter.
Right, right. I mean, I've seen, I'm not as plugged into the prepping preparedness world as I used to be. I don't keep up with some of the forums and things that are discussions that happen out there in it. And for a while there, I did a while ago, like 10 to 20 years ago. And I do think, though, it has been informed by the ideas in regeneration and some of the concepts in permaculture to be better, to be more realistic, to not just be the solo lone wolf survivalist, you know, classic image.
Yeah,
because that obviously won't work. It's obviously not very resilient or enjoyable. And to kind of have different components like community and improving soil and improving land base to be a good steward. I've seen those concepts come in. So some of the like regen ag and prepper worlds have kind of combined a bit. And I think that's a good thing. I think both can be bettered by it. I think, yeah, there's some potential challenges in it too. But overall, I think it's been a good thing. I mean, and I think the people who co-opt either, especially permaculture, I think it becomes clear after a while. Like there were so many more permaculture courses 10 years ago than there are now. I think the world weeds itself out. I mean, I'm not a pure free market capitalist type of view, but I do see that the market does weed out, you know, bad versions eventually of things that are just less legitimate,
sure.
Especially if there's not crazy amounts of marketing behind them. But we are seeing that now with some forms of ag and climate stuff for sure.
Yeah. What do you see as some of the biggest myths or misconceptions that continue to be propagated around regen ag and homesteading that you're aware of? Or that you wish would die off a little faster?
Yeah. I mean, well, in permaculture, the idea that, you know, you could just not do much and you know, the designer's the one in the recliner. I never understood that. I mean, it's a very active, hands-on existence. I don't know. No one's going to be harvesting my crops and bringing them to my kitchen and processing them for me. So there's, you know, a ton of work at all stages. I mean, that idea that it's like less work, I think that the work, the type of work changes to be much more interesting and varied. But I don't know that it becomes less work. Instead of just sitting in a giant combine, you know, to get money to then go buy your food, you know, you're just in your garden growing your food. You know, there's just a swap there. And to me, that's very worthwhile. But I don't know that, you know, less work is necessarily, I think that's a little bit of a myth. I don't know what other myths are real common, you know, I think that, you know, the idea that regen ag has to feed the world is an interesting kind of quasi myth in that, like, the world's already being fed, actually. It's a distribution problem. And that also, you know, I've come to think we definitely need, and I've heard like Jean Fortier talking about this a bit in the last year, that we need like more like a billion new gardeners versus a million new farmers kind of idea, just like more producers. I mean, I think the idea of scale, that's a real farcical thing. Like, it's not valid unless that's cool. Now scale it up. Like that should not be the metric. And I think that's just a holdover of us like having industrial minds is that, okay, it's only valid if now you can do that cool thing you're doing on your homestead at 1,000 acres. So, you know, you can provide X, Y, and Z for 100,000 people from it. It's like, no, that we'll just end up in the same place if that's still the mindset. Sure. I mean, that's a clear, we're not solving the problem at the same mental place, like Einstein quote type of thing to me. Sure. As it can get. I think we really do need the different model. And I think that's kind of a myth. And So focusing on like, you know, quality over quantity and replicability, not scalability, I think is what we really still need to come to and hold as the high bar.
I guess along those lines, where do you see a lot of people's efforts misplaced or maybe out of order when they're starting a homestead, putting too much importance on certain things when the reality is different?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it varies a lot. But I mean, I've done hundreds of consults, so I get to see people from all walks of life for the most part. Not all, but a lot of cross-section of people. Some who have land, some who are looking for land, some who neither, and they're working, you know, in an urban garden or whatever. And I think people just miss the scale of permanence really reliably, like early on, not respecting the scale of permanence, and that leads to a lot of problems. So remembering, you know, the order of operations and how it relates to those less changeable and more changeable features and elements of the landscape is important, and not just landscape, but humanscape too. And also, I think people just being very idealistic that they're going to like quit their day job to do permaculture when they still have a certain number of bills. You know, I see a lot of people who have the most freedom as still like hanging on to some like fairly lucrative job part time, but then they get to do what they really want to do on their land without the monetary pressure to wring those dollars out of this homestead system or small farm system, which is all the odds are stacked against you in this industrial society to have that be economical. That's why it became almost
extinct. Why small towns are dying. Yeah.
Right. So what, I mean, we have to change the rules of the game, not just play the game, you know, better or differently. And I think one way of changing the rules of the game is, you know, is to do that, is to just stay in the system for something and then just say, hey, I'm just going to do this differently. For me, every time I've gotten a really big yield out of something, for the most part, I've felt like, oh, now I can sell X, Y, and Z because I have a lot of it, like honey or something. And then I'm like, oh, no, this is too valuable to sell. And I feel that way because I do other things for money, design, sell plants, my book, things like that. So if I did need the money, I would sell the honey. I mean, it'd be really high end honey. And I have sold thousands of dollars worth of honey. But the more I'm able to pay the bills with other things, the more I'm like, wait, this is just, you start getting very attached and very appreciative of the things you can actually grow and produce on a small scale system. And you realize that it's not something you can buy. Like that's what ultimately we come to is like, wow, I can't buy honey like that. There's no honey a fraction as good as that at any store around here, no matter what. If I walked in with hundreds of dollars of bills, I couldn't buy it. So why the hell would I sell it? I want to have that honey for myself. Yeah. And that's happened with a lot of things, you know, our meat, cows we've raised, and that's a quality thing, you know, a little bit of a sidebar there, but.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it really speaks to the value that gets put onto something, not only for the quality, but for the fact that you went on a journey with it, right? That is also part of the equation that you will never be able to replace buying a product from somewhere else. Best case scenario, you could probably get more value out of it, solidifying relationships in your community by trading or bartering it with somebody, you know?
And exactly.
When you become a small-scale producer, I think it brings in the actual value of what you're doing beyond just what it can fetch in a marketplace through binary interactions.
Yeah, exactly. And through the anonymization of currency. Yeah, we had someone last year, they came by for something. It might have been sea berries or some honey or some meat or ciders we made. And they didn't want a lot. And so I was like, well, here, just take this. And they're like, well, how about 20 or 40 bucks for it? I'm like, it's too valuable to sell. Like, if I got you a lot of it, maybe I would ask for some money. But with this amount, you just don't give me any money because putting it in those terms, like, isn't accurate. It's too valuable to sell.
I mean, and they were
like, what do you mean it's too valuable to sell? It's like, then they got it. It's like, no, it's in the category of gift and trade, which is more valuable than monetary. So. Yeah, we feel that way with a lot of stuff. And then same with people that have traded with me. I've gotten, you know, something else in return that's just, that feels that much intensely valuable.
Yeah, it's strange. And, you know, it took me a while to figure this out and some really awesome interactions from mentors, from neighbors, from people I've encountered in my travels. When you start to value possessions, items, consumables beyond what the monetary value of them are, and rather the associations, the journey that they've gone through, the people that they've come from, and the connections that were made through the exchange of those things, rather than just what you paid for it.
Yeah, and we have so far to go to really like to trust that. We really have to, we just want to have numbers, and it's like we are, it's an industrial mindset thing. Like, what's the worth? You know, I need a number to know. And it's like, well, you could just, like you said, you just said it very well. Like, what is the story? Whose hands touched that? Just how does that feel of value to you? And just go with that. And like, but it's hard to trust that. But I think when we do it, it feels so worthwhile and so correct.
Yeah.
We have a long, maybe we have to practice that for years and years. And then ultimately in generations, we could have that be our baseline ways of interacting, you know, maybe again.
Oh, but talk about something to aspire to as a culture.
Yeah.
There's a metric you can put on that.
gift culture. It's hard to even not sound crazy when you think about it now, you know?
Yeah. Well, so let's focus now on the second edition of this book that many people listening probably know your work through. What have been some of the expansions, the new ideas that have made it into this based on the experience you've gained in between the time when the first edition came out?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I brought a copy here so I can remind myself. You know, I just brought up a few things like the cows. We've been keeping cows. We didn't have cows before the first edition. So I'm now still a beginner, but I'm 4 years into having cows. We had cows some other years, some neighbors' cows, but I'm 4 years into having cows of my own. So that's got a piece in here. Bees, the beekeeping, and then the honey management and ferments and things we make from honeys have been, and honey products have been a big focus of mine. I've probably spent more time on that than I have been even vegetable gardening and or focusing on growing perennial crops, which was such a big focus in the first 10 years. So that's got a piece in here. And then greenhouses as well, because I was really just finishing our first big glass house when the first book went to press. And then there's a ton of optimization stuff with the wood heat. We've just done a lot of work on optimizing and done three more wood stove hot water systems since the first book. So got to like do way more experimenting with wood heat and multifunctional wood heat cooking and water heating since the first edition than before the first edition. That's to some extent in here, although we also are doing online courses to get at things that the book, you know, the book couldn't get more than 30% bigger. So I couldn't go as in depth as I wanted on some of this stuff. That's when we do some online courses.
Yeah, I did see that. You've got a couple of mini courses on your website now that go deeper into some of these.
There's going to be a lot more, but yeah, exactly. We could, you know, some of these things deserve, you know, an hour or two or five or 10 versus what I can give them in the book. Pond making is going to be a big one of our online courses, which is going to be quite a few hours long to get really into depth, like kind of like a pond masterclass, so to speak. But yeah, the pond, there's some updates about pond making in here as well, about each species, you know, what species we've gotten to really prove. I've got a list of all the species that didn't work on these two sites, and because they're not hardy for the most part, and some other reasons, heavy soil being a challenge to some of them. Yeah, those are some of the big updates. There's a whole section on raising kids in the homestead and on land. That's a big new piece on its own. Pretty much almost a small chapter. It's a small chapter in of itself. Different lessons I've learned from, you know, 5 years. At that point, 5 years of raising a child on the homestead, 5.5. Different tools that are appropriate for them. A curriculum outline, things like that. And then there's a bunch of other new food storage strategies discussed in here, especially drying. And there's something else I just saw, which is totally new, which is a whole section on mulches, like breaking down different mulches, because I didn't really on that enough in the beginning. And also we use leaf clip lawn clippings more now, grass clippings. So that's like a whole new breakdown, pros and cons of different mulches. And I think what I shrunk in the book is just examples of design process, because the book could only get 30% longer, but there's, let's say, like 50% new stuff. So we had a 20% spread there.
Very cool.
And then there's a lot on zone one. There's more on zone, no, zone zero. There's more on zone zero, a lot more than there was before. Zone zero being body, mind, health, maintenance of the human being who is needed to be in pretty decent shape to be a beneficial member of the rest of the system of zones.
Yeah, like you were saying, the work doesn't necessarily diminish, it just transforms as systems change. And I can imagine that there's no gym membership needed with this lifestyle.
No, and there's so many little health hacks, if you will. I don't really like the term hacks because it's not, they're not shortcuts, but yeah, a lot of little health strategies that I outlined in the book that are have become practices in my life to just maintain vitality and vigor. And those are shared as well. Those are in the back of the book.
Fantastic. Well, I guess the last question then would be, how has this experience and your learnings in this journey affected the way that you work with clients and the advice that you give to newcomers?
Yeah, I mean, I think it always just it's just all ground truthing, right? I mean, it's all the ability to just speak from experience versus, hey, I heard this or I know of someone who does this, which a lot of people depend on to do work for people. And, more and more, I only speak from direct experience. If I'm on a consult and like, oh, what about this system? What about doing, llamas or something here on the, as a, okay, I've never done llamas, so I don't even talk about it, but there's enough that I can speak to with direct experience that we can do, multiple hours, just them mining my benefiting from my own direct experience. Like, hey, I worked with those systems for 3 years and this is what I learned. Or yeah, I have that system and I'm 15 years into it and this is what you need to watch out for, and this is why I won't work here on your property, and this is why it needs to be like close to your house or whatever it is. So it's all just, I mean, there's no end to experience, to the value of experience, to be able to talk about an ever wider array of things with others to help them avoid mistakes you've made and optimize. I don't know that it's, I always felt that was really important, so that's why I kind of always tried to focus on experience. And like why we never offered a permaculture course until we had been here like 6 years and things like that. Like I always felt like that's what I want from people. I don't want, oh, hey, I read this. I mean, no, I want you to tell me how it is because you did it. Yeah, there's just, I think it's just an ever wider array of that I am able to offer clients. But I don't know, specifically. I mean, I think one of the specific pieces is that I am ever more aware of just the limiting factor of time and okay, like how much time are you really going to spend on this property doing what you say you want to do and getting kind of the realisticness of meeting goals and helping people prioritize to meet their goals that in a less pie in the sky way, like really just realistic. You're okay, you have three kids. Like now I have a kid. I know what that means. Like before I didn't know what that meant. Oh, okay, yeah, you have kids, didn't have kids. Maybe I would not address you differently enough in my advising. And now it's like, okay, having a 6-year-old, you have a sense of it. That's a huge, okay, you can't do this and this probably, or you might want to be careful. Like you've got that huge commitment. Yeah, the it's all none of it's all none of it's separate from life. It's all work, life interwoven. And so that's what I'm offering when I work with clients is just, that lived experience. And it's more nuanced, every year that I have under my belt.
Yeah, and it's really valuable to have done this as a lifestyle as well, instead of just designing it for other people. And I've practiced this in many different ways in many different parts of the world, but my own understanding has deepened incalculably since I have, well, now made two efforts at really putting down roots. The first one didn't work out, though I had every intention to do it and was living with it every single day. And now, hopefully, this one won't fall apart quite as soon or ever, but when you're here, you're observing the differences. You're living with the consequences of your design choices. It's a totally different ballgame when you go to a client's place, give some suggestions, maybe implement a couple features, and then walk away and tell them to check in once in a while. Very different game. And so you
I could not
encapsulate
agree
this.
more. That is so, so true. I say that all
Yeah.
the time.
Well, and you encapsulate this well in the little caveat that you give in the web pages for the online courses that you have on your website, which is there are so many different voices and teachers out there at the moment. This is the reason, through your experience and having lived this for 2 decades now, why you've been able to put value into some of these courses, and that when in doubt, just talk to an old timer in your area who has lived this for longer rather than spent all their time marketing and doing the business side of telling people about it instead. You know, there's a very different quality of learning from those two ways of going about it.
That's like such a big change. That's one of the biggest changes, to get at your question earlier, that we've seen in the last 10 years. So when we last talked, if you were out there offering a lot of words and content on this field, like, you probably had a bunch of experience, but then social media and YouTube viral videos and algorithms and the marketing awareness of millennials and younger came into the purview and into the playing field, so to speak. And that just flipped everything on its head. So now, you know, like, I did a consult the other month for a couple that has like a giant YouTube following. I don't like maybe like 500,000 people. I hadn't heard of them because I didn't follow them, but they're like huge. Like, so many people know of these people, and for homesteading advice, like, that's their channel, is like homesteading. And they're like, maybe they're 14 months into it or something. You know, they just moved from this to do it. And it's like, wow, our world is run by marketing. You know, our world is 98% marketing as far as how money flows, and 2% the real value of experiences behind it. And it's unfortunate. And yeah, we're trying to navigate that, like, how to deal with that.
Well, look, so that people who are listening know where to find some knowledge from experience, how can they get in touch with you and find more about your book, where to get a copy?
Yeah. You know, the book I sell on my own website still until I'm out, which is going to be pretty soon, but maybe I'll buy another palette at that point, or the publisher direct, Chelsea Green Press, and better than going to Amazon for everyone. And our website, wholesystemsdesign.com, has, you know, our courses and online, and our permaculture course, which has a handful of spots left for this summer still. And yeah, my Instagram's pretty kept up with. And those are some good channels. Whole Systems Design.
Fantastic. Well, Ben, thanks again for making time to talk with me about this, to go deeper behind what has informed the information, not just the information itself. It made for a really enriching conversation. And I look forward to catching up and digging into some more stuff like this, maybe getting some advice from my own early stage of this journey at a later time.
Sure. Well, I appreciate it as well. I think we covered some less usual but really important stuff here. So it was a great conversation.
Thanks once again to Ben. You can find all of the links and contact and resources that he mentioned at the end of the episode on the show notes on the website at regenerativeskills.com. Now, before we wrap this up, just remember that these episodes are only the beginning of the learning resources, design and coaching services, in-person courses, and interactive community that are available through Regenerative Skills. The Discord server is our free community where you can connect with other like-minded listeners, exchange ideas, stories, tips, and resources, as well as interact with me directly and quite a few former guests from this show. Our Instagram account, @regen_skills, is the best place to see the projects that me and the team are working on, both for clients and collaborators, as well as on our own properties. I'll also be announcing the certification courses, workshops, and gatherings that we've got coming up later this year. If you're interested in getting dedicated support for your own project, you can now schedule a free planning session with one of our team members through the request form on our website. You can also find all the links, show notes, and past resources there at regenerativeskills.com. We truly believe that no matter your experience, your knowledge, abilities, resources, or background, you can be a powerful force for regeneration on this planet, and we're here to help you find your path. So as always, remember to keep taking those little steps every day towards a regenerative future, and I'll be right by your side along the way.